From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And as we march toward Election Day in this country, U.S. soldiers continue to march toward the Iraqi city of Mosul, where they'll help guide Iraqi and Kurdish forces who are trying to retake that city from ISIS. The operation has been going on for more than a week now. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter now says the Mosul mission is part of a two-pronged assault to claw back ISIS strongholds in the Middle East. He told NBC that the next target is Raqqa, the de facto ISIS capital in Syria.
It's been long a part of our plan that the Mosul operation would kick off when it did, as is the plan that goes back many months now, and that Raqqa would follow soon behind. So we've planned for that, and we have the resources for both.
But ISIS is fighting back with suicide car bombs, and the United Nations says the group is rounding up civilians to use as human shields and has been executing others. Joining us now, NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Hi, Phil.
Hey, good afternoon.
And Ash Carter says this was always the plan to go after Mosul and Raqqa, but he seems to be saying the two offensives will overlap. What are you hearing?
That is an interesting thing to hear from the leaders of the Pentagon, because they said that the Mosul offensive would be right around the corner for about a year.
Right.
And they began to manage expectations after they first started saying that in 2015, and eventually got to the point where they could support the Iraqis and the Iraqi leaders could give the order for it to begin. So I don't doubt that they intend for pressure on Raqqa to continue and for an offensive to take place at some time soon, as we heard Secretary Carter there say, but we don't know exactly when that will be or what soon actually means in this context.
Well, and we'll talk about Raqqa a little bit more in a moment. But first, let's talk about the attack that is going on right now, the fight for Mosul. What do we know about it so far?
We know that it continues apace. We know that the Iraqi and American leaders who are overseeing it were pleased with the first few days of progress, but they also have been careful to condition expectations by everyone that this will be a long fight. It could be a very bloody fight. And there are a lot of unanswered questions still about how ISIS in the city itself will respond when these Iraqi forces with American support actually get there. Will they stand and fight? Will it be a Stalingrad-style nightmare of house-to-house fighting and building bombs and all the other horrors that American forces very sadly came to know in the previous Iraq war? Or will ISIS do kind of a fighting withdrawal, which is what it's done in other places in Iraq, where it tries to take as many of the enemy with it as it can, but doesn't stand to give a force for, in this case, the Iraqis and the Americans to destroy, and instead tries to move out and keep its fighters in being? We just don't know how they'll respond once we actually get there.
Well, we've heard Donald Trump say over and over again that because the U.S. gave so much warning for the attack on Mosul, that a lot of ISIS fighters probably left. Do we have a sense of how many people are still in Mosul at this point, or how many have just fled?
The Pentagon says there are between 3,000 and 5,000 fighters in the greater Mosul area, but it readily admits that's just an estimate. There's no way to get, as Pentagon officials would say, a precise nose count of exactly how many combatants are still there. Lieutenant General Townsend, who's the top American commander, said at the Pentagon yesterday that, of course, these guys move around within their caliphate, as they describe it. It's territory they conquered and which they control. So they have some freedom of a movement. But he was also quick to add the U.S. watches from the air and space very carefully how the Islamic State moves people around and moves vehicles and weapons around. And so it can keep very close track of that. The trick is, how much can they do about it? Where can they target? And where is it too dangerous because there's a risk of hitting civilians, for example?
So what about this idea to also retake Raqqa in Syria? It seems that Syria would be a much more difficult place to launch that kind of an attack just because of all of the various forces that are there, some of whom we're not very close with.
That's exactly right. It's a much more difficult challenge, and it's very different because the U.S. has a relationship with the government of Iraq. The government of Iraq has provided these forces that can mass and move with American support like a conventional army toward Mosul. In northern Syria, there's this group of various kinds of people from all over the area, the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces, which includes Kurdish fighters, local Arab fighters, other people from around the Middle East. Turkey is also very interested to be involved and potentially control how any offensive against Raqqa would go, because it does not want to empower some of the Kurdish forces that it considers its enemies. And the United States doesn't have as much ability to put trainers and support troops and other aspects of military operations close to the fight in the way that it can in northern Iraq. So if and when the offensive begins, it could look very different from this Mosul offensive that we've been watching now.
And of course, we'd also have to be worried about how the Russians would play into any offensive to take back Raqqa. But I want to just ask you finally about the idea. On the one hand, the Obama administration would say we've got to take these cities back because this is ISIS's way of saying that it's reestablishing the caliphate by having actual territory in the Middle East. On the other hand, a lot of Americans worried that we're just getting involved in another war that will never end.
That's why the Obama administration and whichever administration follows it has to calibrate the American involvement very carefully, because it wants to empower these local groups, the Iraqis in Iraq, these other groups in northern Syria, but not have anything like, at least so far, a commitment the United States had in the Iraq invasion in 2003. So it wants to help them from afar, but not actually put American lives in peril. And as we hear politicians in the presidential campaign talk about so much, put these troops on the ground. It's been able to do that so far, although those forces haven't been as quick as effective as American troops themselves might be if they were in the lead there.
That's NPR National Security Editor Phil Ewing. Phil, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
Well, here in the U.S., early voting is underway, and a record number of people are participating in Texas. Another record there, 15.1 million Texans are registered to vote this year, and a good number of them are Latinos who have recently become citizens. But how many will actually cast ballots? Andrew Schneider from Here Now contributor Houston Public Media reports.
The M. O. Campbell Educational Center in North Houston is built to house massive events, concerts, graduations, and once a month it hosts ceremonies like this one, where nearly 3,000 people gather to take the oath of citizenship. Most of the people at this ceremony came from Latin America. Some have lived here for decades, but only applied for citizenship this year. One of the main reasons is because of what can happen after the oath is taken.
Now that you're United States citizens, you are all eligible to vote.
Citizenship applications generally spike during a presidential election year. This year, they're on track to pass 1 million. Most observers credit the increase to Donald Trump, a backlash to his campaign pledges of mass deportations and construction of a wall along the Mexican border. Jonathan Biso came to the U.S. from Peru when he was 16, more than 20 years ago. He just became a citizen in September.
My voice needs to be heard. I want to leave a legacy for my daughter, which is a U.S. citizen born here. She's 8 years old. And things like this cannot go on.
Republican officials have expressed concerns that Trump's remarks about Latinos and immigration could cost the party down the ballot if Latinos come out to vote in force. That's a real possibility in close contests in places like the Houston metro area. Hector De Leon is the head of voter outreach at the Harris County Clerk's Office.
There's going to be about 100,000 more Spanish-earning registered voters eligible to vote in the 2016 election than there were in the 2012 presidential election.
Still, not everyone who registers to vote actually casts a ballot. Mark Hugo Lopez is director of Hispanic research at the Pew Research Center.
Latinos have trailed oftentimes blacks and whites in about a 15 percentage point to perhaps more than 15 percentage point difference. And that was true in 2012. It was also true in 2008, 2004, 1996, 1992. You see the pattern.
Nationwide, Hispanic voter turnout is falling even as the number of Latinos eligible to vote rises. That's largely down to age. About half of all eligible Hispanic voters are millennials. That's compared to about a fifth of all eligible whites. It's a lot tougher to convince young people born in the U.S. to vote than it is to motivate newly naturalized citizens. High schooler Edna Alvero was born in Texas to parents who emigrated from Mexico.
I'm only 17, so I really, really, really wish that I could vote, but I can't. I'm not eligible to. But these kids that are able to do so, they're like, well, I don't want to vote. I just don't have to vote. Why do I have to vote?
this obligation freely.
Houston Public Schools held a campaign to register every student eligible to vote. Carlos Duarte, Texas State Director for Mi Familia Vota, says getting millennials to register in larger numbers is key to building up Latino turnout over the long term. But
there has not been an investment in the Latino community by any political party or other people that actually invest in getting the vote out. Everybody just hopes that this is going to be the year and just magically people are going to turn out to vote. That is not going to be the case.
To the extent the national parties are reaching out to Latinos, they're focusing on battleground states. They won't waste limited resources on a state that's solidly red, and Texas is expected to remain red until more Latinos come out to vote. For Here and Now, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
And it's been a year since human cases of the Zika virus emerged in Brazil and spread throughout the Americas and parts of Asia, causing congenital Zika syndrome in newborns when Zika passed from mosquitoes to their moms to them. Many were born with severe microcephaly, a much smaller head than normal when brains don't develop properly. And these newborns have a distinctive plaintive cry. NPR's Rob Stein recently sent this sound from Brazil. And it's heartbreaking. So how are these babies doing today? Well, not well. Dr. Camila Ventura is an ophthalmologist on the front lines at the Altino Ventura Foundation, a government nonprofit that cares for low-income patients. She was there when the first babies were born. We've reached her in Miami, where she's just started a fellowship at the Bascom Palmer Eye Institute. Dr. Ventura, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be talking to you, Robin.
But a terrible topic to talk about. The pictures we're seeing start with the babies born with the devastating brain injury that results in microcephaly, you know, born with a smaller head. How are they doing?
Yes, the ones that are now 1 year old, many of them, they present seizures, they reflux.
Acid reflux?
Exactly. They choke many times. They have difficulty in swallowing. So it's very hard to teach mothers how to feed these babies. Many of them, they need help with the feeding. They cannot feed naturally, like breastfeeding. Many, because of that, are malnourished, so they really need to be in the hospital and be treated intensively. Yeah. But now we see also that they have motor delays. So like the milestones that they were expected to achieve at this point, like 1 year old, they should be at least walking with help. They are not. So we are treating them. We're doing physiotherapy. We're doing all the rehabilitation process, which involves a multidisciplinary team. But yes, they are severely impaired. And visually also, they're not achieving the milestones that we were expecting for the age. So they're neurologically, visually, and audiologically impaired as well.
It's just the pictures we've seen are devastating. You mentioned the seizures, and these are painful. Pain medications don't seem to work. So sometimes there are these babies who are crying 24 hours a day.
It's true. So in the beginning, we didn't know what was causing really the cry. And it's a neurological cry. They cannot stop crying at all. Mm. So it's like a puzzle. And we start treating something and then we find out something else. And they have lots of spasms, muscle spasms. So even when they try to sleep, the spasms wake them up. So also they get irritated because of that, you know. So it's very complicated.
Yeah, and we understand, too, that staying again with the microcephaly and the known Zika babies at birth, people thought, oh, they have good reflexes. But it turns out these are more like a rigidity that's not good. Like if someone tickles their foot, they'll sit straight up.
Exactly. Yeah. So they have these primitive reflex, and they are not good. So many mothers in the beginning would say, oh, look, but my child can sit. Mm. It was just like a primitive reflex, and it's really not what we expect for the age. And then the mothers realize that the baby is really not evolving. evolving, is not developing the way the baby should. Oh, and they actually, they have this primitive reflex where they simulate a crawl. So they were like 2 months old and they were crawling, like, and mothers were so proud. Oh, no, see, my baby will walk because he's crawling already. And then they realize it's not the reality.
It's just a reflex. Well, look, this is bad enough. But yes, we understand what's also happening is that microcephaly isn't the only indicator. And babies that people thought were born healthy are actually now, months later, starting to show problems?
Yes. So one of the findings that we're seeing is that babies with microcephaly at first, they're now becoming hydrocephalus, which is water in the brain, because you're producing liquid and it's stretching, let's say, the skull and the brain, and it's getting bigger than normal. So it's really the reverse. So the baby started with microcephaly, and then suddenly it's the baby is now developing hydrocephaly. And also another finding that we're seeing is that babies that were born with normal head circumference, and with time this baby now developed microcephaly. So we really need to follow these babies. We don't know the long-term consequences of this infection. What we know is that it's a broad spectrum. These babies can present from very mild, let's say, neurological finding, like little calcifications, all the way to no brain at all.
Yeah.
Very, look, very sad.
Very sad, doctor, and very shocking, I'm sure, to these families and even to you, the doctors who are watching this.
Yes, but you're right.
Do you think these, I mean, are these children going to live long?
This is a very good question. In the beginning, we thought that they wouldn't reach 1 year of age. But we started treating them, and all the seizures and all the systemic issues, we're doing the rehabilitation, and they have been gaining weight. And of course, the neurological development is not okay. But the rest, there's no infection. Of course, they can have infection, because since they have reflux, they can bronchoaspirate and have pneumonia, and they can die from these kind of infections. But so far, in our institution, we have 339 babies, and none of them passed away. So they're now 1 year old, and we just don't know really how long they will live and how well they will live. This is the issue.
Well, and I understand this has provoked a lot of conversation among people like you doing this incredible work caring for these children. How much do you tell parents to intervene and care, or when do you start talking about palliative care? You tell me, what are some of the questions?
No, really, we don't get to the palliative treatment right now, because these children, these mothers, these families, they have gone through so much. There's no way we can right now address any sad news. Yeah. We just need to be with them and provide them with care, really.
Well, I hear you that you don't want to pile on what is already so sad, including, I mean, how are some mothers handling, there's a certain cry that comes from some of these children. It's a shriek, really. And when some of them are crying 24 hours a day, this is tremendously difficult for mothers. How are you helping them deal with that?
Yes. In the beginning, this was true. This was real. These children, if you see now how they are doing, the cry is almost gone, really, because we have been detecting all of the issues and addressing all of the neurological. If it's the seizures, we have been treating. So mothers are really happy right now, because they can sleep, and they have seen that treatment has helped them so much. So that's why they are so convinced that the treatment is the way to go here. And they will go every week and be seen by us, our team. Some of them have to be seen every week by the neurologist. Sometimes they need to be seen every 15 days by the hearing ENT. So it's every child is seen individually. Although we have group therapy, we believe that mothers, they can share experiences experiences. So we always have for mothers psychological support. We have a psychologist that have been working with them since the beginning. And in the beginning, mothers, they would cover their babies to walk in the streets. They were really so afraid that people would be judging them and having all the prejudice. But now they have a support group and they have been doing so many different activities as a group and talked over, like conferences. Mothers are giving conferences and telling other mothers what to do when their child is not sleeping well, a position that they discovered that before they didn't know. And now, because since they discovered it and the child has a better way of sleeping, they are teaching how other mothers can do the same for their babies, you know. So it's a really exchange of experience, and mothers have become really strong. And let me tell you, it's really the mom. The dad, but fathers, we know a lot of stories that fathers left the house. This is really sad, but it's true. The mother stayed with the child and the father left home. Many of these mothers, they could not continue working because they had to be 24/7 with their babies, taking care of their babies. So it's hard also on the economical side. Many of these families, they are from a low income population. So it's very, very hard and tough on these families. But we have been helping and providing them with many times medication, food, and it's been a long journey. But so far, we have been managing to treat our babies.
Yeah. And to have hope.
Oh, yes. Always.
Yeah. That's Dr. Camila Ventura of the Altino Ventura Foundation in Brazil. Dr. Ventura, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Robin.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
Twitter announced today that it is cutting 9% of its workforce, or about 350 jobs. It's also shutting down Vine. The social media company has struggled for much of its 10-year existence, and recent high-profile efforts to sell the company have backfired. Joining us now is Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
And this is not Twitter's first round of layoffs. What's happening this time around?
No. Earlier this year, 300 layoffs. So Twitter has been trying to pare back a little bit before, but now it's really going after trying to save money so it can refocus, really try to double down on its users and its strategy.
And try to make itself more attractive to a buyer, because we know that Salesforce dropped its bid to buy Twitter. Disney has bailed out. Are these layoffs designed to make it more affordable?
Yeah, it's tricky. Those buyers didn't step up. Nobody wanted to buy Twitter. And it's a tricky company because it's a $20 billion company, roughly. And so that's a lot of money for a company that has a dicey sort of revenue strategy right now. It's not working. And so it seems like what the company has to do is figure out how to make it work before people will step up and buy. With these layoffs, the company's expecting to save probably between $50 and $100 million a year.
So what about this other news that Twitter is shutting down Vine, the short video sharing app?
Yeah, that was a great experiment, a video that just has simply got surpassed by Instagram and some other online video sharing platforms, Snapchat, for instance, too. And so I think this is just goes back to the company saying it needs to reprioritize and refocus.
You know, in the news business and in politics, Twitter is a pretty big deal. Most journalists working on daily news these days have Twitter up all the time so they can see a real-time live stream of what's going on from all over the place. Obviously, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and other politicians use it all the time.
It's massive. Yeah.
But I wonder if we're getting a skewed view of the importance of Twitter because of that, because we all use it. And in most people's lives, Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, much more important.
You've put your finger on what's exactly the issue for Twitter. It's a very different social network. It's not with your friends. It's with anybody. It's a very open communication platform. And so Twitter has done really well with influencers. And if you watch TV and you see the hashtags on TV shows, it obviously takes up a lot of mind share. But it doesn't always attract new users because they mainly want to connect with their friends. And so that's the issue. And I think this open communication has also made it this kind of stomping ground then for online harassment. And so that's something that's turned a lot of new users away. It's an open communication platform, and it's just a very difficult thing to control. It's different than Facebook and these other social networks that people want to be on all the time.
And the other social networks, you notice that they make big changes more frequently. Twitter still looks a lot like it used to.
Yeah, when Jack Dorsey came back to take over the company as CEO again after 6 years, it was basically the same product as before.
That's Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, with the latest with what's going on with Twitter today, cutting 9% of its workforce and shutting down Vine. Kurt, thank you.
You got it.
It's time now for a special edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. We're going to be listening to music heard in New York and specifically from the city's many immigrant communities.
Ветер в поле закружил.
Капли яры, капли пары, лага тире назар.
Oh, no, no, ¿qué será de mí si no es realidad?
Gary Sullivan hosts Bodega Pop Live on WFMU's 24-hour alternative stream, Give the Drummer Radio. He joins us from New York. Hi, Gary.
Hey there. How you doing?
I'm doing well. And the interesting thing about today's DJ sessions is we've got music from really all over the world or all kinds of different cultures. Tell us about how you do your show. How do you find all this stuff?
Well, I've been searching for music here in New York City since 1997 when I moved here. And originally, I was just finding music in, you know, traditional areas, record stores and so on. And then at some point, because I was very interested in international music, I discovered not very far from my house in Park Slope, Brooklyn, a Syrian bodega on Fifth Avenue in Brooklyn. And this woman was selling CDs in a little bin for, I think they were $5 a piece. And I picked up one on her recommendation, and then I picked up four others. And that started me off.
The rest is history. Well, let's get to some of the music. This is from Nigeria. It's by Rinkar Experience. This is called Fuel for Love. Great beat there. This is from the 1970s. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's from 1972. It's by a band called Rinkar Experience. It was founded by two Cameroonians, actually, Ginger Forcha and Edo Jacques Racine. And they basically were working in Cameroon. And then there was a big scene, you know, post-Nigerian Civil War in Nigeria, a big rock scene fomenting. So they moved to Nigeria and they recorded this single for EMI, and it turned out to be the biggest hit in Nigeria for a long time.
And is there a big Nigerian community in New York?
I don't think it's huge, but I found this actually when I was riding my bike out in Corona, Queens, very far east in Queens, almost as you're getting towards the stadium. And I needed some water, so I pulled my bike over to go into a bodega, and I noticed a couple doors down a sign for Nigerian Video. And I just went in, started talking to this woman, and she recommended this one CD called Flashback. She said, I think you're going to like this. And so I picked it up. And I took it home, and it was all these early rock hits from the 70s in Nigeria. I was blown away, of course.
I'm beginning to get the sense that if I'm ever in a scavenger hunt in New York, that you're the person I want on my team because you can go and find these little gems in the middle middle of nowhere.
Yeah, I have a knack for it, I have to say, yeah. It's true.
Well, let's get to the next one. This is from Lebanon. Again, something you found in New York. This is by Najwa Karam. It's called Ru Ruhi, or Soul of My Soul. Tell us about this one.
So that's Najwa Karam. She is probably one of the biggest deals in Lebanon even now. She started out at a very young age. She won a contest called Lebanon Nights when she was a kid. She was born and raised in Zal, the mountains of Zal, which is largely a Christian area. She's Christian. She went down, she defied her parents, got in a car without their permission, and drove down to Beirut to be in this contest on TV, and she won it and got a contract out of the deal, I guess, and then recorded her first album at the age of 24 in 1989. This is 10 years later. By this time, she's already starting to become incredibly popular around the area, so much so that there was a rumor circulating about her that she had, in an interview, confessed to naming her dog after the Prophet Muhammad, which was not true, but basically really made it her life difficult for a while. She was denied entry into Egypt when she went there to go perform at some hotels in Cairo. So what happened was she basically went back into the studio, recorded this album. This is in 1999. And on the cover of this album is her in a scarf and giant chunky sunglasses looking exactly like Umm Kulthum, of course, Egypt's biggest voice. I'm not sure whether that was a finger to Egypt or whether that was a come-on play. My guess, considering Najwa Karam, it was probably saying, you know what, I'm just like you guys, here I am, emulating Umm Kulthum, your biggest hero.
Let's get to another one that you found. This comes all the way from Thailand. It's by Pumpong Duong Chan. This is My Ka. What attracted you to this one? And tell us about it.
Well, I picked this up in Fort Worth, Texas. I was there in Texas with my girlfriend, who is Lao in background, but was born and raised in Texas. And we were visiting her mother in Fort Worth, and we knew that there were a bunch of Lao stores in the neighborhood, so we drove around, and I found several CDs with the same-looking woman on the cover. Turned out they were all Pumpong Duong Chan, who was from northern Thailand, Isan. And when my girlfriend's mother got in the car with us later on, she wanted to see what I had picked up, and I showed her, and she said, you know, this woman's very famous. She actually had died very young of a blood disorder in 1992, and basically what she said is this woman was so famous in Thailand that anyone who wants to cover her songs, even to this day, has to go visit her grave to ask permission to do so first, which I thought was an amazing story. But yeah, she's the biggest. She basically electrified what's called Luktung, which is northern Thailand, Isan area, kind of Lao in nature, actually, music.
There is something so unique, though, about the sound of music from Thailand as opposed to any other country.
There is, absolutely. And I mean, I think that it shares obviously a lot with Laos, and it also shares some with Cambodia too. And then, of course, there's a Western influence that begins to kind of warp it a little bit. And that track, it's so raw, and it also kind of sounds like it's falling apart as you listen to it, but it doesn't quite fall apart. I really love it.
Well, we have time for one more, and this one comes from China. I am not even going to attempt to say the name of it in Chinese, but this is The Fly. It's called The Good Life.
Hello.
So did you find this one in Chinatown?
I found this one actually in Brooklyn's Chinatown on 8th Avenue in a sort of DVD store that I've been going to for a very long time to find Hong Kong movies. And I bought it for a dollar. It turned out this is the first punk album in China. It was released in 1997, not in China, but in Taiwan, because they couldn't find a release for it in China. The band was basically formed by this guy, Feng Jiangzhao, who is a very famous artist now. But he basically got his start. He was listening to what are called Dachau cassettes. What those are cutout or sawgash cassettes and CDs in the United States. We basically were had some sort of deal with China that they were going to go to China and be landfill. And someone got the bright idea on the Chinese side to resell those in stores in the, I believe, the 80s and 90s. And Feng Jiangzhao basically learned music by listening to these cutout cassettes from the United States and was heavily influenced by the Sex Pistols and Nirvana, who I guess he must have picked up early on.
Well, very interesting stuff from all over the world and yet from all over New York City. Gary Sullivan, host of Bodega Pop Live on WFMU's stream Give the Drummer Radio. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And we've got all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
That's music from the new Bollywood movie This Heart is Complicated, directed by Karan Johar. It opens Friday after a Hindu nationalist party in India withdrew its opposition. The head of the MNS party is calling for all Pakistanis to be banned from Indian films after 18 Indian soldiers were killed in September in an attack that India blamed on Pakistani militants. Karan Johar's film features the Pakistani star Fawad Khan. This is a big deal. Initially, the director argued that since he made the film before the flare-up, he should get a pass. Then he abjectly apologized and said on YouTube videos he'd never again make the mistake of using actors from a neighboring country.
I need to say this, and I say this with strength, that for me, my country comes first. Nothing else matters to me but my country. I've always felt that the best way to express your patriotism is to spread love. And that's all I've ever tried to do through my work and my cinema.
Well, journalist Siddharth Bhatia wrote in response that the apology made Johar look like an errant student, like a hostage, which, in fact, Bhatia writes, he was. Siddharth Bhatia joins us now by Skype from Mumbai. Siddharth, welcome.
Thank you.
When you say a hostage, you mean metaphorically. So let's remind people, you have Hindu-dominated India, Muslim-dominated Pakistan. They were once one. They were split in 1947 and have since been at odds, long battled over the disputed border area, Kashmir. But how did these tensions spill over into Bollywood?
You know, Hindi films, Bollywood films are very popular across the border. Pakistani soaps have been coming into India for many years. In fact, Fawad Khan was discovered in one such soap. He became quite a heartthrob with the ladies. So there was no problem. But periodically, something flares up. This time, the trigger was, the excuse was the killing of 18 or 19 soldiers in India, which India has directly blamed on Pakistani-based terrorist militants. So this party took advantage of that situation and said that Pakistani actors should not be allowed. But after standing up for it, initially and resisting, Karan Johar just capitulated, gave in. And that video was, you know, carrying things a bit too far. As you said, it was abject. And he was a hostage. He was a hostage not just to this party and its ideology, but also to this growing sense of intolerance in this country about anything which does not agree with your point of view.
Well, he's not the only one who's standing up and saying things, perhaps forced, as the director Johar was, or because they want to. You have actors who have stood up and said, I'm not going to act with Pakistani actors. You have film festivals that have rejected films that have Pakistani actors in them. Can you tell how many of these people are feeling pressure from the Hindu Nationalist Party, and how many are doing this because this is how they feel?
I can't say for sure. The thing is, I doubt whether this is the general mood in the country. Because, you know, people love to listen to Pakistani songs, watch Pakistani television serials. And in the past, when Fawad Khan acted, they went and saw the movies anyway. So I doubt whether there is social or societal pressure of any kind. But everyone wants to, especially the film industry, which has no record of standing up to anything except a stray exception.
Well, but you say usually the film industry, they just want to make these terrific Bollywood films. But you have a warning for your countrymen, because not only do people appreciate the films that these Pakistani actors are in, but you write, don't be surprised, we read Pakistani authors, we Facebook with Pakistani friends, we write about Pakistan. Don't be surprised if that can be declared anti-national.
Well, that's obviously a little bit of journalistic rhetoric. But the point is, who knew 2 years ago or 3 years ago that we would be asked to stop watching a movie with a Pakistani, or the filmmakers would be asked to stop making films with Pakistani. We didn't know that. So I feel that we have reached a point of absurdity. And this point, the bottom has not been reached. Tomorrow, anyone can say anything. You know, there are a lot of Indian-Pakistani marriages. Some pressure may come on them of some sort. It hasn't. And the government has clearly said that there is no official policy. But don't forget that in the past few years, there's not been much cricket between India and Pakistan, thanks to pressure, again, from nationalist parties, especially in Mumbai. And who knows what's going to be next? We live in kind of trepidation. So this was, I was only trying to press the point. But yes, there is a sense that this is going just too far.
That's Siddharth Bhatia, founder and editor of The Wire, News from India. Siddharth, thank you.
Thank you.
And here's more from the soundtrack to the Bollywood film, This Heart is Complicated. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.